You're listening to Trent Radio 92.7 FM. If you don't like it, your cat will.
And this is Pilot K9 and Jam with Manlisher. Hello, come on in.
I can't.
Oh, right, sorry.
Hello, folks.
Sorry, I didn't lock the door. Anyway, there was no Manlisher today. Uh-oh. I don't know what happened. But I did get to use a little of the BBC World Service to fold into the mix.
Yes, the good old BBC. So what are we... Oh, we're silent in the background.
Let me get some noise going here then.
You're right. After all, this is Art Space, Noise Space.
Were you at Art Space last night for the opening?
I was not, actually. There was an opening last night?
Yeah. That's how I feel. I checked my email today, and, you know, there it is.
Oh, there it is. And in point of fact, if I had have known about it, I probably wouldn't have been able to make it out anyways.
I was very
busy. You know, it's that it never rains, but it pours.
Yeah.
You know, you never get just like one thing to do. It's always like a dozen all at once.
All right, well, let's fade in a little Gordon Monahan. Have you heard him before?
No.
He's an experimental composer, and he's built some fantastic sound sculptures, some of them enormous.
Oh, yeah.
He's put wires through rivers.
That guy.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
I didn't know his name. Guy. There was one that I saw where he did this huge field with these huge wires that would resonate in the wind. I don't know if it's the same guy.
Yeah, and they were connected to a piano?
Could have been. I just remember it being like just crazy sound. And also watching it, realizing like I'm not even hearing a fraction of what's going on there.
Right. It's I would like to be at one of his installations. It's quite physical.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
The long Aeolian piano
is
at the top of a hill. He puts a piano.
Yeah.
Pounds stakes into the ground to hold the thing there. And from the soundboard, he stretches wires. The soundboard acts as the resonator for all of the wires stretched all over the hill.
Oh, okay.
And they go in every direction, so no matter which way the wind is blowing, you'll get sound.
Doesn't matter which way the wind blows.
And if you're there actually on site, it's pretty damn loud.
Yeah, no, it would be. And it would also be one of those types of things where you could actually walk around and get different standing waves.
Oh, definitely.
And, you know, like it would be definitely one of those immersive sound environments, which is very cool.
The best part about it was I saw a video of him, and he was bouncing up and down on the guy wires holding the piano. The whole thing was a giant whammy bar.
Wow.
But this one is speaker swinging, it's called. And this is a great environmental sound installation.
Mm-hmm.
What he's got is just three sine wave generators.
Okay.
Or I guess he does generate different waves, but it's all very simple.
Right.
Man, he's got three dancers positioned in the room.
Mm-hmm.
They've each got a speaker connected to one of the oscillators.
Okay. Yeah.
And they swing it around.
Right.
And because of the Doppler shifting, mm-hmm. and the speaker's moving towards you or away from you.
Yep.
And because of their relative location in the room and the different rates at which they're swinging,
mm-hmm.
you'll get a very rich soundscape.
Yep. Ascending and descending. Nice.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say that where I saw, what was the guy's name?
Gordon Monahan
was on TVO.
Right.
And I think it was around the time they were doing a lot of stuff on sound, because they also had a big show on R. Murray Schafer. And one of his installations where he took a barn and used all this old farm equipment. So it was all stuff that he had salvaged. From all the old farms surrounding his place, and built this elaborate thing all through this barn. And the initial trigger was he opened the upper doors where you normally dump the hay out. And when he opened those, it was a huge metal sheet that was hanging on ropes that when it swung would then start these pulleys, and then that would,
and
you know,
everything
cascade.
Else is hanging
everything
from
else is hanging from wires, and things are like, you know, so you'd have like huge saw blades banging into pieces of tractor that was quite awesome. And again, one of those things where it's it would be an immersive environment that would be awesome to walk around through and get all of these different tonalities and yeah. sounds going on. But that actually reminded me that TVO has recently done a deal with YouTube.
You were talking about this earlier.
And that kind of makes me intrigued anyway. Where basically, from what I understand, they're going to have a lot of their programming available directly through YouTube.
Are you gonna, can you watch or can you actually download?
Well, there's with YouTube, you can download. I mean, you know, there's various Firefox plugins, etc., that just allow you to grab any of the Flash format files that are embedded in a website. Now, as to whether they're going to have it, because with YouTube, you can make available a video available for download.
And right.
More. But, yeah, I don't know. Because I do know that one of the main parts of the deal is that TVO will be receiving some of the advertising revenue from YouTube.
That'll help.
Yeah. Well, and I think that it's very progressive in terms of embracing this modern technology and pushing it forward. I mean, the BBC's already been, you know, working on getting their entire archive online, particularly for the people of the UK who've actually paid for that programming anyways.
Yeah, they still have to pay licensing fees for TVs over there,
yeah.
don't they?
Yep. And that licensing fee is what pays for the BBC and all of its development and stuff. And I'm of mixed minds there, right? Where I see that it's allowed for them to avoid a lot of the trappings of commercial television, while at the same time, sort of. BBC kind of rocks. I mean, there's a lot of the shows that come out of that, particularly documentaries, in the same way that Canada, with, you know, CBC and TVO, also, you know, make some really dynamite documentary stuff. And because it's not predicated on a commercial.
Right. TVO also shows homemade art videos.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Less so these days. I'd like to see it do it more.
Yeah.
I remember when I first started watching TVO, well, I used to watch it all the time as a kid because it was one of the three channels that we got.
Uh-huh.
But when I, you know, as a more adult in the late 80s, early 90s, I really started paying attention. And there was a period of time there where Daniel Rischler, Mordecai Rischler's son, was right. the creative director, I think that's what he was called, or programming director. At any rate, he was spearheading all of these amazing shows. Open House, Film International, Imprint. A lot of these shows have gone on, but he really spearheaded a lot of that stuff. And so there was a lot more of that kind of more experimental stuff at that point in time. Which I was very excited by. but as is the, the times, the, you know, manners,
right.
as things shift. You know, like I say, fortunately, they're still doing a lot of the documentary stuff. One of my favorite shows on TVO is Big Ideas. I don't know if you've seen that. I never know exactly. It's usually on Sundays. That's when I catch it anyway.
Yeah.
All kinds of just amazing debates and lectures and stuff from various people. One of the early ones I saw that was quite interesting was this series of presentations by different speakers around the theme of the common good. And
that would be interesting.
It was very interesting because two of the speakers were Ignatieff, Michael Ignatieff.
Yeah,
is that his name? Yeah, and Bob Ray. and to be honest, this was the kicker, Linda McQuaig. Do you know Linda McQuaig?
She's
written some very awesome books, including, is it Shooting the White Rhino? I think that's it. But it just basically talking about debt and what debt really is and how it is this kind of... and one of the things that she was putting forward at that time was the Tobin tax, which is an extremely small tax on financial transactions. And that sort of showed the numbers how in, I think it was like 1 week, the debt would be erased just because there's so many billions of dollars being exchanged every day.
Right. Yeah, the money market isn't taxed.
It isn't. No, not at all. And this is talking about like 0.1 or 0.01% tax. Like, it's a minuscule tax. It's not even close to something like the GST, which everyone else has to pay. You know, so it was just, it's one of these things that could actually, it's a radical idea that could very quickly flip the economic situation. So she was putting these sorts of ideas forward as ways of realizing that we're not as stuck as we are being led to believe. So she had that whole speech, and then of course Bob Ray gets up and completely sticks his foot in his mouth and comes off as a complete buffoon. This was of course before he became a liberal. But this was
I shouldn't laugh.
This was a sign, because basically his take on it was that if you put in a new tax, then it's going to be, you know, Joe down the street that's going to have to pay it. Like, there's this automatic assumption that it's going to be somehow offloaded onto the average person.
I don't think Joe down the street is trading currency.
No, I know. But, and this is why I said, you know, like, I already had my issues with the guy, but that seeing him on that just made me go, I do have to say that I understand some of where he's coming from, in that when he got voted in, he inherited a massive debt. And so in order to balance the books, he had to make some very difficult decisions, which were not necessarily his own fault, but were, you know, sort of inherited. And, but unfortunately, that whole fiasco gave the NDP a bad name across the board.
Didn't he try and pursue debt reduction in almost the same way the Tories would have?
Yeah, no, it's true. So, I mean, he definitely did not, use any kind of radical thinking at all, you know. And I think that's what he sort of shows me, is that there's no new ideas there.
Right.
There's no kind of like trying to come up with radical new solutions, which is really what we need to be looking at right now. And I think it's Einstein that said that you cannot solve a problem with all the same stuff that created the problem in the first place. I'm probably paraphrasing that wrong, but it's something along that line. It is a good point, in that I think that, you know, a lot of the problems that we're facing right now, we're not going to be able to solve them with the same old stuff. You know, we're going to be looking at things like the Tobin tax and like those types of ideas.
Yeah, well, I hate seeing proposed solutions for pollution or for the companies that made the problem promised to clean it up as long as they're heavily subsidized.
I know. And then they end up they get all the subsidy, and then they don't clean it up.
Right.
Because, you know, that's not what their game plan in the first place. My own feeling is that in what should be implemented is something that basically equates profit with responsibility. So if a corporation is making the maximum, or making, you know, X amount of profit on something, then they need to be responsible for the entire life cycle of that product, including the disposal. So it's like, you know, the amount of profit you make off of something equals the amount of responsibility you have of cleaning it up after the fact. That makes sense to me.
Right.
But good luck trying to get them swallowing that one.
The price of the product is that we pay.
Yeah,
is not. It's only a fraction of the whole price of it.
That's right.
because the manufacturer, the refining materials, every step of the way creates pollution.
That's right.
Which everybody suffers from.
That's right. And
it's been known for 150 years that pollution kills people.
Yep. But, I mean...
The disposal problem, that's taken care of by the taxpayer as well.
Right. But we're dealing with a world where there are these think tanks that are set up specifically to do things like disprove global warming. You know, which we all know what the mandate there is. Mm-hmm. Can we avoid this problem as long as possible? as we said, you can't solve a problem by using all the same methods that created the problem in the first place. I was just actually reading about there's been some think tanks that are being set up to come up with ways of using the open source methodology for democracies.
Now, you'll have to explain that.
Well, one of the I'm reading off the screen as I'm talking. Don't do that to me. One of the things with open source development is that it is a transparent collaboration between, could be thousands of people across the world. If you go to sourceforge.net, right. You see all this software that's being developed by all these people. And it's done in such a way, similar to Wikipedia, where it's open for people that want to plug in to participate in.
Right.
Sort of applying this to the situation we're in terms of social, political kind of thing, what we need to do is look at look at solutions that actually bring input from as many people as possible. So, and this includes, sort of political decisions. So I think that one of the things that I have in mind with it is the idea that if you are being affected by something, then you have the ability to plug into the system that is trying to create solutions for that thing.
Right, so you can join the debate
exactly
on things that affect you.
Exactly, and directly. Now, a part of that is to keep things as open as possible so that, anybody that's interested can see the process. It's completely transparent. I think that's a really major part of this.
That's very important, yeah.
Because it's one of the things that right now is not happening on so many levels. In terms of especially political decision making, an example recently that really makes me tweaky is in the last election, not the one that just passed, but the one before, there was a thing about proportional representation, which of course was, first of all, nobody was educated as to what proportional representation meant. The process by which they came up with the methodology that was being proposed, which is the mixed member parliament.
That's where you cast a vote for your party.
Yeah.
And one for the representative.
That's right.
If they're not necessarily,
the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Perhaps your local representative doesn't.
Right.
Doesn't meet your needs, but
right.
You still support the party federally.
That's right. Yeah. I mean,
hopefully a step in the right direction.
Yes, but at the same
hopefully
time,
hopefully it won't make things
right.
Overly complicated.
Right. Well, what ended up happening,
spawn
of course,
a huge bureaucracy.
Right. What happened, of course, is that people didn't know what it was, and so voted it down because there was a huge amount of disinformation that came out surrounding it.
Sure. Well, if people don't know what it is in the first place, it's easy for the vested interest to say,
spin
well,
it.
Communism.
Yeah.
That's
yeah. Yeah. Put in
or
generic
whatever.
Word that people hate or have come to, see as evil. and that's exactly what happened. So that, it kind of died as quickly as it was born without anybody really realizing what it meant. and what it represented. Because in this last election, it really would have been handy. Looking at, you know, because for myself, I mean, a major part of it is that, like, if you look at the various voter kind of numbers across the country, you see that it's not completely evenly split three ways, but it's pretty damn close.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, there is this, but the thing is that with the first past the post, it doesn't matter, because what happens is the winner wins, and right. And all of those votes that are cast for the other people are basically discarded and meaningless, which is, I think, the reason that most people feel that democracy and the voting system is not working.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if you go and unless you vote for the winning party or the winning person, which is the same, then you're basically throwing your vote away.
Right.
Whereas with something that's you know, proportional representation, the other thing that goes with that, and this is something that's not been talked about either, is graduated voting, which means that instead of just an X beside one person, you number the candidates in order of preference. And what this allows is, instead of having this strategic voting thing, which is about gaming the system, I mean, it's not about democracy, it's about gaming the system, which inherently says that the system's not working. So rather than addressing the fact that the system's not working, we just keep, again, trying to use old solutions that keep spinning on the same spot. I'm not a big fan of partisan politics across the board. I think that that's something that it goes along with the demagogy, right, rather than democracy, which right. creates polarized issues, keeps people, you know, kind of battling against each other on really trivial matters, so that they're not actually looking at the matters that really matter.
Because yeah, you don't have the time and energy.
That's right. That's right. And you're too damn mad at those other guys.
If you can keep people pissed off, you can keep them from making rational decisions.
That's right. That's right. And, I mean, that's, of course, the sort of situation that we're in. Now, I see that you've brought up the Artspace website.
Yeah. We can talk about the 12 hours of Artspace, but yeah. This is Darcy Island, the...
I just wanted to have a look there, and there's no information about 12 hours yet.
Ah.
Okay. So...
This opened last night.
Uh-huh.
We missed it, and right. it's on until the 26th, which would be next Friday?
I guess so. Oh, I wish I had my Linux box here, then I'd be able to see a calendar really easy. okay.
No.
Never mind.
No, you can. There's a calendar tab.
Is there? Is there one?
Second from the bottom.
Oh, there it is. Ah, there we go.
But it's for 2004.
How the heck? Okay, that's just weird.
Never mind that. Let's just count it.
I give up.
If today's the 22nd.
Yeah.
23rd, 24th. Wednesday. It's on until Wednesday. Only.
Okay. That is so odd. Oh, there we go. Thursday. 27th?
26th.
26th. Okay, it is Wednesday.
Okay, well, let's read what it has to say.
Okay.
British Columbia has a leper colony.
Whoa.
Its existence is not widely known, for those who compose it are of a race whose affairs never reach the public ear. This is taken from the Dominion Medical Monthly, Ontario Medical Journal, December 1898. In the 19th century, Darcy Island, a small island off the east coast of Vancouver Island, was used by the City of Victoria to quarantine the residents diagnosed with leprosy after the discovery of the disease in a few people in 1891. The exhibition Darcy Island is part of a larger project, Carceral Landscapes, which is concerned with the use of landscape as a device for human incarceration. The idea of carceral landscapes was germinated by photographer Ansel Adams' belief that the sublime beauty of the natural environment surrounding the internment camp at Manzanar, California, inspired and helped Japanese-American internees transcend their detention during World War II. Darcy Island critically considers the use of an island as a site of detention or banishment.
Shall I go from there?
Go. Yeah, sure.
Sure. While the floor of the Owens Valley is desolate, very hot in the summer, and very cold in winter, the surrounding mountains are spectacular, especially the Sierra Nevada on the west, culminating in the Mount Whitney, rising 14,500 feet above the valley floor. The Inyo Range to the east is more of a desert character and of low elevation, but is very beautiful in its own way. I've been accused of sentimental conjecture when I suggest that the beauty of the natural scene stimulated the people in the camp. No other relocation center could match Manzanar in this respect, and many of the people spoke to me of these qualities and their thankfulness for them. And this is from Ansel Adams, An Autobiography, 1998. Social history is inextricably tied to natural history, and Lethbridge artist Don Gill's investigations have produced a convergence of the two, often evolving into case studies which the artist documents through photography, text, video, and installation. His practice has been one of critical questioning based on explorations of specific sites and their social histories. These sites are often in proximity to where he finds himself geographically. He is currently a visiting research professor at Trent University. Very interesting. Yeah, I'll have to get down and have a look at that. And of course, we were just looking There's a headline for 12 Hours of Art Space, but
no content.
No information yet. which, of course, I do know that it's coming up. The actual show's going to be the 26th or the 28th, is it?
I think maybe you should check your email.
It is. Right. Reaching my email here would be a major hit.
I'll check mine. I'm sure okay. I got a message about this.
Yeah. Because, yes, I know that we've decided to pull the 12 days of Christmas back to 12 hours because 12 days was just exhausting. Hey, what's with the mountain range?
Oh, there's a new background on Gmail. That's kind of nice.
I did actually get a message about there being themes available now. But I tend to check my email through Thunderbird on my machine, so I never actually see the Gmail homepage. There's the piece for Steve Daniels, which is still going on there. It just says
tomorrow.
Right, coming soon. Yeah, because I know that the it might be that we have advanced information.
Here we go. It's a call for artworks.
Right.
So this is going on November 27th and 28th.
Right.
That would be Thursday and Friday.
Yeah.
Following last year's extravagant 12 Days of Art Space, an abbreviated version of our winter holiday fundraising art. So I shouldn't laugh.
No, but it is kind of cute.
You have 12 hours to shop.
Right.
12 to 6 on both days.
This is sprint. It's sprint shopping rather than marathon.
Well, I really liked the 12 days last year.
Yeah.
It was a lot of work, though.
Yeah, I was just going to say, though.
I set up the sound system for bands about four times, including for us, Full Metal Booty.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was a lot of work involved.
It was. And I'm sure that at some point it might come back around to doing a full 12 days again. But I think this year's been particularly busy with a bunch of stuff happening. And
especially with a lot more programming in the mudroom.
Yeah. Yep.
Like there have been three shows there in the time that Steve Daniels has had the front gallery.
Yep. No, it's good because it's what we've been trying to get happening at ArtSpace, which is utilizing the mudroom to its fullest in order to showcase and nurture local talent.
Right.
Which is which is very cool. And I think that it's, you know, expanding on what recent ArtSpace, because I think that that's something that, that used to happen a lot years ago, like especially the Market Hall days where there was a lot more.
It did, but well, in those days, well, it's not a fair comparison.
No,
they had a lot more money.
Well, exactly, and more space, and this
13 employees.
Yeah,
including all the part timers.
Wow, yeah,
amazing. Now we got two.
Yeah, well, and I think this is where it's we've been in the process of kind of building ArtSpace back up again over the last, you know, 6 years in particular. Because I mean, coming from the Hunter Street location, that was quite tiny.
No, it was too small.
It was too small, and it didn't allow us to really offer a lot in terms of resource, you know. And I think that's been, you know, an ongoing process. That was why we moved into the King Street location in the beginning, was because it was so much larger.
Right, but we only lasted 7 months there before we were wiped out in the flood.
Yeah, but that's, you know.
Shame about that.
Well, I mean, and then that's where we you know, we bounced up to Sadler House and then down into the one location in the building we're in now, but then...
And now we're next door.
And now we're next door, where we have this, you know, full extra gallery space.
Yeah, well, I'm especially happy that we have a storefront now.
Yeah.
Because as I remember at Hunter Street, well, there was there was a storefront.
It
was, there was kind of a small art space sign.
Yeah.
And people still went to the Market Hall.
Yeah, looking for it.
Yeah. At a time when ArtSpace hadn't been at the Market Hall for about 9 years.
Mm-hmm. Yep, old habits die hard.
Well, it just, I mean, that shows that we didn't have any visibility in the community.
Yeah, yes. Well, I know that when I first came down to Peterborough, and that was in 2002, the reason that I found out about ArtSpace was because of Lester.
You knew him before you came to Peterborough, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I've known Lester for quite a while. I first met Lester in the early to mid-90s in Toronto. I was living down there for a year, and he was going to York University at the time. He was studying film, of course.
York, that's the one that's way, way out.
That's right. Yep, up in the burbs.
Oh, man.
Yep.
Yeah. A guy at my house, Jerry Marr, used to go there. It took him forever.
Yeah.
An hour and a half there and an hour and a half back.
Yep. Well, yeah, I was in, I was involved in a few different things, but the thing that would draw me up to York most was being in a student film of not Lester's, but another woman, Mashan. And so I would go up to the campus a couple times a week to do rehearsals and stuff. And the bus ride, wow, the TTC, because it was multiple, you know, catch a streetcar to the subway and then the subway to the, and then catch a bus to the, it was crazy. And it did. It took a long time to get out there.
And there wasn't an express bus either. It went all through suburbs.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. No, it was the milk run. But at any rate, with Lester, him and his partner Tammy, they were living up in Lake St. Peter, next to where I was living, which Lake St. Peter is just below Algonquin Park. And they were looking at stepping down here to, you know, kind of spread their wings and get connected to a larger scene.
Peterborough's a good place to do that.
It is. And I do have to say that having spent time in Toronto, I far prefer Peterborough in terms of coming from a rural background. It's a kindler, gentler place. And more specifically, it moves a little bit slower. Toronto, I think, is just manic. It's just a manic place.
I don't know. It's not that bad. I still walk at Toronto speeds if I'm walking alone.
Right.
That was a pretty weird experience to come back to Toronto from New York and find Toronto to be slow and small.
Right. Well, and I mean, I guess the other thing for me is that when I spent time in Toronto, I felt that there was this, well, I did telemarketing for 10 months. it left a bad taste in my mouth. But at any rate, I'm not actually sure how it was that Lester heard about ArtSpace, but there was some sort of submission process going on at the time, and he submitted some videos to ArtSpace for something that David LeRivière had initiated, and I was along for the ride. So me and Lester walked into the Hunter Street location, and the first thing I saw was a poster of Genesis Peorich on the wall.
Right.
And it was an ad for him playing the Pleasure Dome. And I can't say for sure, but the style of the poster, I suspect the poster was actually done by a friend of mine, Potemkin, who's a graphic designer in Toronto. And I actually know him through the anarchist scene, through Dragonfly, the commune that I lived at in Lake St. Peter. And so it was one of those things where I walked in and I saw that poster and just went, oh, home. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't long after that I heard about Full Metal Booty. It was actually probably David mentioning it right there.
Probably, yeah.
And the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah, we had just started out.
Right.
But by the time you joined, that was about the time that we actually realized that we were starting to listen to each other and respond to each other.
Right.
Which, you know, before that it was a bit more chaotic.
Right. High decibel chaos.
Yeah, well, we hadn't really found our way yet.
Right. We just needed me to come on.
Yeah.
I was the glue. Actually,
and
in
Stu.
Those...
And Stu joined about the same time.
Yeah, he came in. Yeah.
I really miss the didgeridoo.
Yeah. Well, I remember one of the biggest complaints that I would hear again about what I was doing was that I was always too low. But
yeah.
I was insanely self-conscious at that point, so tended to like to just bury myself in the mix.
You stand out on some of the recordings from that time, but you're definitely clearer now.
Yeah. As my confidence has increased.
I was listening to some jams a couple of years old with John still doing vocals.
Oh, yeah.
And it's really too bad that he had the feeling that he just... done all that he could do with his voice at that point.
Yeah.
And he retreated to his solo laptop stuff.
Right. Yeah, I haven't heard anything that he's been doing, so what's...
I just heard little fragments.
Okay. Is it more song-oriented or more noise-oriented?
I've heard so little of it, it's really hard
to tell.
It's
hard to say, yep.
He's still grappling with the basics of multi-track recording.
Right. For the uninitiated, it can be...
It's a pretty steep learning curve.
Yeah. I mean, I'm fortunate in that I came into it quite gradually. Having a tech background to begin with probably helps a lot, too.
Yeah.
Going back to when I was living at Dragonfly, I actually helped Tammy... record one of her first albums called Dirty Head. Tammy Lester's partner. And
you did that with a four track?
Yes. A cassette four track. I think it was a Tascam that she had rented from Steve's Music.
Right.
Actually, she rented a whole equipment piece, like a set. So,
right. So mixers, microphones, and so on.
Yeah. A little effects rack for the vocals.
Nice.
So she rented that for 2 months, came up to Dragonfly where I was living, and said, Wayne, give me a hand with this. And I got her rolling, and then I do have to say that she just blows me away. How, you know, she's not a technically minded person, but she is at the same time when she's engaged with it.
She has kind of an intuitive grasp of it.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, it's the sort of thing where I know that she couldn't explain to you what she's doing, you know, in a rational way, but she really pulls off some cool stuff. Actually, if you go to originalplastic.com these days, her and Lester have been doing weekly instant videos.
Right. Yeah, you've played a couple of them.
Yeah.
And the song.
Yep.
I was really impressed that she was doing all of those loops and extensions
live. Yep. And that's the whole point of this series that she's doing, is that she's actually doing it live with her looper, which is, it's so funny because it looks really easy on some levels, but I know from having tried it that it's not as easy as she makes it look.
The looper, that's it's a digital delay.
Yeah.
That does it have like a 12-second delay or something?
Yeah, even more than that, actually, if you can. Yeah. But yeah, she and what it also does is that loop you can either just keep it playing and sing or play over top of it, or you can add to it and it'll, you know, so it's got an overdub mode. And so this is what she'll do, right? Is she'll start out with something very, very simple, right? And then add a couple layers to it and then use that as the bed track to sing over. And then add some more stuff. And so you get this like really nice complex sound, but it's very tuneful. She's a songstress.
And because it's a digital recording, it doesn't decay like like my big long delay here.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's here, it's going through a bunch of different processes before it's coming back.
To digital, to analog, to digital, to analog.
Yeah. But then there's like a couple of the tunes where she purposely actually creates this big, thick, heavy sound.
Right.
Which is very groovy. I mean, this is one of the things that I find with her stuff, is that she's extremely psychedelic.
I would say.
Which is something that I totally appreciate about her music.
They have an SK-1 as well, don't they?
Yes, now she has an SK-1. Oh, well, I mean, between her and Lester, they've really been trying to get over the years amass as much good equipment as they can.
Right.
Because she also has a VS880, which is an 8-track digital recording system.
Right. That's what we need.
Yeah, although she's running into issue right now in that she doesn't have a really good storage system for it. Because guess what kind of plug it has on it? SCSI.
No way.
I mean, she, you know, it's an older piece of equipment. She's had it for a while now.
How old?
6 or 7 years now.
Yeah, I thought SCSI was a dying format long ago.
Well, it was, but that didn't stop a lot of the manufacturers from, you know. Because now, here's the thing, is that she's been going on eBay, and there are some of these units that are made specifically for it. And I think this is part of it, is that it's, again, that proprietary thing.
Right.
Where they create something where you need to buy their equipment in order to expand on it.
Right. When I'm looking at anything like that, I think maximum versatility.
Yeah. And, I mean, that can vary greatly. I hate, you know, one-use machines. And unfortunately, right now, there's a lot of them out there. iPods. Not a big iPod fan myself.
No, not at all.
Particularly because, anyway, there's a lot of digital rights management systems that just kind of tweak me out. Which is part of the reason why myself I'm looking at different approaches, as I've talked about before, things like Jamendo and other avenues for music rather than iTunes, because there's been some new stuff coming out about some of the digital locks that are on iTunes stuff. And
isn't there a free download that you can get that's supposed to turn them into MP3s or something?
That's part of it, is that those things are A, illegal in certain places in the world. The Apple Store is actually not allowing those. So there's certain, like, they call them jailbreaks, and it's exactly what it is, right?
Uh-huh.
And that's part of what I'm referring to, is that Apple is actually fighting those things tooth and nail, and trying to keep their devices locked. And, you know, trying to pressure various governments to outlaw this sort of practice, etc. Which is actually one of the things that we need to be paying attention to right now. We have a conservative government in power, and they tend to favor some of the more draconian approaches to digital rights management. I would suggest people go to michaelgeist.ca.
It's Mike, one word?
Yeah, Michael Geist.
And it's G-E-I-S-T?
Yes. And he's, most people will probably know him for writing in the, is it the Star? I think it's the Star, or the Globe and Mail. Anyway, one of those newspapers. You're going to go look. But he...
No, actually, I want to get prepared for the next guys.
Right.
Well, it's going to be Parker. I think the Holos Amigos is last week.
Right. Yes, so they're every second week. But yeah, the with Michael Geist's website, he's up on the latest in digital rights issues. I, of course, have him on my RSS feeds, where I get all my news and wonderful insights into the world from.
RSS.
RSS. Yeah, Real Simple Syndication. and basically any website where you see one of those little orange squares with radiating lines in it, that is an RSS feed. Like the ArtSpace, that's not the ArtSpace website. Particularly on the new blog page. Ah, come on. All you. There we go. But yeah, RSS is just a way in which a website can stream itself. You see, up in the...
That.
Yeah. And yeah, like it's a little orange square with these, you know, little radiating lines in it. But yeah, if you look, if you click on that in Firefox, it comes up with Wave subscribing to it. And basically what it'll do is it'll... Anytime a website is updated, it'll give you the latest, like, headlines and little teaser. Sometimes it'll be the whole article. But it means you can have all of your news websites located in one little location without having to actually go to the sites themselves.
Right. And I've managed to lose a bunch of those over the years.
Right.
If I go through my email piece by piece, I'll be able to get some of them back.
Right. Yeah, so I would recommend that anybody that really wants to keep abreast of a lot of different websites, find out about RSS feeds. They rock.
Great.
Particularly with things like blogs, newspapers, those types of things. I've actually been really getting into this one site lately called Subrealism. I figured you'd like that one.
Yeah.
So try typing that in. Subrealism, and I think it's .com. Might be .org. Let's have a look at .com first. Nope, that would be not. try .org. It's always tricky what the extension is going to be.
It is .org. The Subrealism Manifesto.
Sure, this is the one I was thinking of, but this is quite interesting. Whoa!
A graph of China's ability to lower the intellectual standards of the world.
I'm not sure I agree with that.
What is that?
I'm not entirely sure. This is not the one I was thinking of, though. Huh. Well, this is obviously very anti-China by the looks of it. It's not what I was thinking of. Okay, try .net. Interesting. Okay, let's look for it.
Yeah, just Google.
Google Subrealism. Yeah, I'll grab that. Just stick it there. Maybe that's
Liminal
it.
Perspectives on...
This is it.
subjective reality, on consensus reality.
Yeah.
Ah.
Yes. So it's actually, I should have known this, it's a blogspot.com. So subrealism.blogspot.com. This guy just comes up with the most crazy things. Really, really interesting. It's one of these websites where any of the articles people can comment on. So each of the articles has with it not only the article itself, but underneath it you'll get all of this feedback going on.
Selection of replies and links as well.
Exactly.
So you can research this in as much depth as you want.
That's right. And that actually is something that I'm very...
Denmark Vesey, the myth of homosexual animals and other mind control techniques of the New World Order.
Interesting. Oh, I see. This is somebody else's website. Okay. The blackest man on the internet. Weird. Huh. All right. A homosexual man or woman has as much choice in the matter as a beaver has a choice in building dams. A spider has a choice of spinning webs. To imagine otherwise, given the evidence of non-human animal parallels for homosexual behavior, the human culture sanctions imposed on homosexual behavior by backwards cultures is simply ridiculous on the face of it. I agree with that, although...
Three-way.
Oh, you see, and then this guy's... I smell a homophobe. He's trying to say that for reasons of survival, the reproductive instinct among the animals is always directed towards an individual of the opposite sex. Therefore, an animal can never be homosexual as such. Well, I mean, it's tricky, eh? I have the feeling that if I were to start digging through, he's being sort of somewhat politically correct in his language to avoid coming across as a homophobe.
Uh-huh.
Is unfortunately a common thing. But I do have the feeling that... Well, because my own take on it, of course, is that sexuality is far more diverse than simply reproduction. That to reduce something as complex as sexual behavior to a singularity is, we were talking earlier about demagogy,
right.
And that to me is what it is. It's trying to codify things in very black and white, either or kind of perspectives.
There's some funny replies to this.
Yep. Bullshit, Denmark. Oh, no, it says Bush shit. Sorry. That's funny. I had some gay-ass dogs, male and female. Yep.
For another viewpoint, you could check out Biological Exuberance. Do you know that book?
No.
Can't remember the author.
Right.
Biological
exuberance. Fine. But to come back to, I find that things like that subrealism, it's just some guy doing a blog. But you can just go randomly twinging off into so many different directions. It's funny.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Biological Exuberance, Animal Homosexuality and Natural Diversity, Stonewall Inn Editions.
Interesting. Yeah, Stonewall, of course, is the standoff point for the homosexual community and the police back in New York City, back in the day.
Right.
How do you pronounce that name? Bruce Bajmil?
I really can't say.
At any rate, in the dimly lit undergrowth of a Central American rainforest, jewel-like male hummingbirds flit through the vegetation, pausing briefly to mate. Right. So he's going in. Because one of the things that I actually saw many years ago was certain species of dolphins, and how it's there are certain dolphins where they kind of mate or pair off. The males will pair off through puberty, and then you know, and the males actually maintain that pairing for life. And in for reproduction, and this is the thing with aquatic mammals in general, is that it takes a minimum of three of them in order to have sex. Whales are the same way, because it's the third one that pushes them together.
Right.
And so it is well known that, that dolphins and whales as well.
Well, with the flippers, they can't really hold on to
each other. That's right. That's right. So they need the third partner to facilitate that. And so with... like I said, with these certain breeds of dolphins, this is something that's extremely common. Like they have a whole, you know, kind of social dynamic. And the females tend to cluster in groups and raise the young. While these male pairs go off and, you know, do their randy ways. And like I said, I mean, to me, that what that indicates is that sexuality is a much more complex thing than simple reproduction. That there are other things going on there that I don't think we totally understand. And I really think that part of the reason that people insist on these absolutes is to give them that false sense of certainty, because they can't live without certainty. And I think that's one of the major issues going on, is that it's the need for absolutes, the need for truth, the need to say this is how it is.
It isn't like that.
It ain't like that.
We demand well-defined areas of doubt and uncertainty.
That's right. We are the raw army. That's, of course, Robert Anton Wilson.
That's right.
My hero.
And there's a documentary out there called Maybe Logic.
Maybe Logic?
Yep. Which is something that Robert Anton Wilson really spearheaded, was the idea of maybe logic. Which is always using maybes rather than absolutes.
Right.
That way you keep yourself open to any new information that's going to come in, and not feel the need to defend an absolute certainty.
Right. New information does have a way of showing up.
That's right. Yeah. And if you're open to it, you can expand your vision of the universe. But if you're closed to it, well, then that's where we run into issues.
A rigid form of logic is very powerful.
Yeah.
But if just one premise is wrong,
yes,
then it's worse than useless.
That's right. It's actually dangerous then.
It'll prevent you from even guessing the right answer.
That's right. And that's, you know, where I think that we're at right now, you know, kind of as human beings is. And I was talking earlier to Parker about various occult figures going back to the early 1900s, and how they tended to be very, very racist, and